Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell. Ana Mateo will bring us this week's health report, and later we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, health officials in the United States reported last week on what they believe could be a medical first. Officials said doctors performed what could be the first double lung transplant on a person whose lungs were severely damaged from vaping. The operation reportedly saved the life of a teenager from the state of Michigan. The young man was admitted in early September to a Detroit area hospital with what appeared to be pneumonia, a common lung infection. The teen was later sent to Children's Hospital of Michigan in Detroit. On October 3rd, he was transported to Henry Ford Hospital, where the transplant was performed 12 days later. Hassan Nehmeh is surgical director of thoracic organ transplant at Henry Ford Hospital. He told the Associated Press that the damage done to the teenager's lungs from vaping could not be undone. He warned parents to think about that and to tell their children to do so as well. Health officials did not release the patient's name, but they did say he is expected to recover. They also did not say what product the teenager vaped or how long he vaped. The hospital released a statement written by the teen's family. It said, "We asked Henry Ford doctors to share that the horrific, life-threatening effects of vaping are very real. Our family could never have imagined being at the center of the largest adolescent public health crisis to face our country in decades." More than 2,000 Americans who vape have gotten sick since March. Many of them are teenagers and young adults. At least 40 people have died. Recently, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported a discovery into what might be causing people who vape to become sick. They identified the chemical compound vitamin E acetate as a very strong culprit. Researchers found the chemical compound in fluid taken from the lungs of 29 patients. In other studies, vitamin E acetate was found in liquid from electronic cigarettes and other vaping devices. Many who got sick said they had vaped liquids that contain THC, the part of marijuana that creates what is known as a high. Many of those patients said they received the liquids from friends or bought them unlawfully. E-cigarettes and other vaping devices heat a liquid into a gas or vapor. Most products contain nicotine, but THC vaping has been growing more common. Dr. Lisa Allensbach is a lung specialist and medical director of Henry Ford's lung transplant program. She told the AP, "Vaping-related injuries are all too common these days. Our adolescents are faced with a crisis." She added that vaping products should not be used in any way. Dr. Neme said the 17-year-old patient's case does not open any new ethical considerations about transplants for people who severely damage their own lungs by vaping. He added, "We hope sharing this patient's story prevents anyone else from experiencing a vaping injury that would require a transplant."
People across the United States are putting up tall, narrow structures to help a little bird called the chimney swift. They hope the birds will use these structures as nesting areas and resting places. Chimney swift numbers are decreasing as the shape and design of the nation's buildings change. People are tearing down old factory buildings and schools. Many of these structures have chimneys, enclosed structures or pipes that release smoke into the air. Today, most American homes do not have chimneys. And many homeowners who do have chimneys cover up the top to keep animals out. Chimney swift numbers have fallen by more than 70% since the 1960s, scientists estimate, and by more than one-third over the past 16 years. That large drop led the International Union for the Conservation of Nature to declare swifts as vulnerable. That is the last step before they are considered endangered. Bird lovers are building chimney-like birdhouses as summer homes for swifts. Several are set up around the city of Birmingham, Alabama, where Greg Harbor has been watching the birds for almost 10 years. "It does give us hope that if we put them up, they will use them," Harbor said, as swifts flew close to a real chimney. George Ann and Paul Kyle often get credit for starting the current interest in building towers. The Kyles told the Associated Press in an email that they have put up more than 100 nesting towers in central Texas. 80% of those built before the birds' March arrival get nests their first year. Hundreds of migrating swifts make use of two of the 6.1-meter tall towers, the Kyles said. Jim Bonner is director of the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania. He says his group has built, or helped with, about 150 towers in Pennsylvania. But the link between the drop in chimney swift numbers and chimney loss is not clear. The flying insects that swifts eat also appear to be declining. University of Connecticut professor Margaret Rubega thinks the cause of the bird's decline could be in South America. "Chimney swifts are fundamentally a South American bird that visits North America for 4 months," she said. Rubega said a big problem is that scientists have only a few reports of small numbers of chimney swifts in the upper Amazon basin. So, they do not really know where the little birds spend the winter, let alone what may be happening to them there. However, three less common Western species of swifts also migrate to Central or South America. Their numbers are unchanged or even increasing somewhat. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Japan's Marie Kondo is known around the world as a cleaning expert and for helping people organize their homes. Her 2014 book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, The Japanese Art of Decluttering and Organizing, has sold millions of copies. But not even Marie Kondo can follow all of her cleaning rules all of the time. The reason? Well, there are two really good ones. Her young daughters, Satsuki and Miko. The girls are now ages 4 and 3. Marie Kondo wrote her famous book before she became a mother. At that time, she aimed for a perfectly organized home. That is what she told reporters for the Associated Press in November. She added that she now understands two important things about parenting. First, children often make a mess. And second, time and energy are limited. Kondo says her expectations for tidying up definitely changed after she had children. When things get very busy, Kondo has learned to ease her rules for order and organization. Kondo's words may please some parents. Several years ago, she faced criticism for having no real idea how messy children can be and how disorganized busy parents can become. Some parents rejected the main principle of Kondo's tidying method, a method she named KonMari. That principle is cleaning up a large number of things all at once. Kondo says the KonMari method breaks all items in the home into 5 categories: clothes, books, papers, mementos, and miscellaneous, or everything else. Kondo suggested that when you organize your books, you should organize all of your books. If you organize your clothes, you should organize all of your clothes. Tidying up, she wrote in her book, should be a special event and not something you do every day or every week. Her KonMari method, she claimed, would keep clutter from returning. However, parents said they could not give so much time to one project while raising children. People without children also agreed with this criticism of Kondo's KonMari method. In 2017, a parent writing on treehugger.com questioned whether she could follow Kondo's calm example at the end of the workday. Catherine Martinko called parenting chaos. Martinko said she could not imagine putting her shoes, handbag, and coat carefully away when she came home, and then sitting down for a relaxing cup of tea, as Kondo did. Martinko wrote that it sounded like life on another planet. In other words, unrealistic. After Kondo's two daughters were born, she changed KonMari a little to better fit a child-filled life. She admits that tidying up one small area at a time might be a better approach for busy, tired parents. For example, instead of organizing all of the clothes, a parent might organize just the t-shirts. Kondo told the AP that changing your actions when life changes is natural. And being a parent, she added, is tiring. Kondo also offered some new suggestions for parents. She spoke to the Wall Street Journal in 2017 about them. One suggestion is to decide how much space to give your children's things. That way, Kondo said, parents can say no to toys and objects that do not fit into the planned area. Kondo's most important suggestion is one she repeated to AP reporters this month. That is, children should see their parents tidying up. Catherine Martinko, the parent on treehugger.com, approves of this suggestion. Act the way you expect your kids to act, she writes. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 1860 was a year of mixed feelings of hope and fear. Americans had hope for the future because they would be electing a new president. But they had fear that even a new president could not hold the nation together. The states of the South were very close to leaving the Union over the issue of slavery. Tony Riggs and Frank Oliver talk about the candidates and the issues in the election of 1860.
After 4 years as president, James Buchanan decided not to run again. Buchanan was a Democrat. His party, like the nation, was split over slavery. Southern Democrats wanted the party to support slavery. Northern Democrats refused. The opposition Republican Party expected to gain votes from dissatisfied Democrats. Republicans had become stronger since the last presidential election in 1856. They felt their candidate would win in 1860.
The Democratic nominating convention opened in April in Charleston, South Carolina. Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois was the leading candidate. He had the support of a majority of convention delegates. But he did not have the two-thirds majority needed to win the nomination. Many Southern Democrats did not like Stephen Douglas. Some did not trust him. Others did not accept his policies on slavery. Douglas did not oppose slavery or the spread of slavery. However, he said no federal law could make slavery legal in a territory where the people did not want it. This was his policy of popular sovereignty.
The Southern Democrats who opposed Stephen Douglas were led by William Yancey of Alabama. Yancey wanted to get a pro-slavery statement into the party's platform. He was sure Douglas would not accept the nomination based on such a platform. If Yancey failed to get the statement he wanted, he would take Southern Democrats out of the convention and out of the party. The Committee on Resolutions considered three platforms. One platform declared that the people of a territory had the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The second declared that the Supreme Court had that right. and the third declared that no one did, that slavery was legal everywhere.
Your country, how came it yours? Before the pilgrims landed, we were here.
William Yancey spoke to the convention in support of the pro-slavery platform. He said pro-slavery Democrats did not want to destroy the Union. But he said someone had to make clear to anti-slavery Democrats that the Union would be dissolved if the constitutional rights of slave owners were not honored. Yancey spoke of the danger of a great slave rebellion. He described it as a sleeping volcano that threatened the lives, property, and honor of the people of the South. He said the actions of the North might cause that volcano to explode. Another convention delegate answered Yancey's speech. He said Northern Democrats were tired of defending the interests of the South. Now, he said, Yancey tells us we must agree that slavery is right. He orders us to hide our faces and eat dirt. Gentlemen of the South, he said, you mistake us. We will not do it.
In this atmosphere of tension, it was clear that a pro-slavery platform would not be approved. The Alabama delegation announced that, therefore, it must withdraw. The delegations from the other six states of the Deep South, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, did the same. Those 50 men organized their own convention. They approved a pro-slavery platform, but did not nominate anyone for president. They agreed to meet again a few weeks later in Richmond, Virginia. The Northern Democrats postponed their nomination, too. They agreed to meet again in Baltimore, Maryland.
The Republican Party held its presidential nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois. There was no question who was the leading candidate. He was the best-known Republican in the country at that time, Senator William Seward of New York. The Republican platform seemed to contain something for everyone. For those opposed to slavery, the platform rejected the idea that slave owners had a constitutional right to take slaves into new territories. For foreign-born Americans, it supported their right to full citizenship. For manufacturers, it proposed a new tax on imports to protect American industry. And for those in the Northwest, it called for free land for settlers and federal aid to build roads and canals. Delegates approved the platform with loud cheers. They would return the next day to nominate their candidate for president.
William Seward was sure he would win the nomination. If not on the first vote, he thought, then on the second. But there was some opposition to Seward, and his campaign organization failed to see its strength. The candidate of the opposition was Abraham Lincoln. The Republican convention voted three times. Lincoln gained support on each ballot, but neither he nor Seward received enough votes for the nomination. Then, before a fourth vote could be taken, a delegate from Ohio asked to speak. The big room became silent. "Mr. Chairman," he said, "I rise to announce the change of 4 votes of Ohio to Mr. Lincoln." That was enough to give Abraham Lincoln the Republican nomination for president.
One month later, the Democrats reopened their nominating convention. Most of the Southern Democrats who walked out of the first meeting came back. Many of their seats at the convention had been given to new delegates. So a new dispute arose over which delegates had the right to be there. A compromise plan split the seats between old and new delegates. But most of the Southerners rejected it. One by one, a majority of each Southern delegation walked out. The remaining Democrats then voted for a candidate. They chose Stephen Douglas. Southern Democrats nominated their own candidate, John Breckinridge of Kentucky. And a group called the Constitutional Union Party nominated John Bell.
The election campaign opened in the summer of 1860. Lincoln was not well known, so the Republican Party published many books and pamphlets about him. They told the story of a poor farm boy who educated himself and, through hard work and honesty, had become a candidate for president. Lincoln's supporters organized a loud and colorful campaign, complete with marching bands and signs. Lincoln himself was silent. He said, "It has been my decision since becoming a candidate to make no speeches. I am here only to see you and to let you see me." In fact, it was Lincoln's assistants who had advised him to say nothing. They believed he had said enough in the past to make clear his position on the important issues.
Stephen Douglas, on the other hand, campaigned very hard. His health was poor, and he had trouble getting money, but that did not stop him from speaking in almost every state. Within a few weeks, however, Douglas recognized that he had no real hope of winning. His position on slavery had cost him all support in the South. Douglas believed that, of the other candidates, Abraham Lincoln had the best chance of winning the presidential election. He also believed pro-slavery extremists would use Lincoln's election as an excuse to take Southern states out of the Union. So he turned his efforts to a campaign for the Union itself. He said, "The election of a man to the presidency by the American people under the Constitution is no reason for any attempt to dissolve this glorious nation."
Election day was November 6th. The popular vote was close between Lincoln and Douglas, but the electoral vote was not. Lincoln received 180. Breckinridge received 72. Bell received 39. And Douglas received just 12. Abraham Lincoln would be the new president of the United States. He would enter office facing the most serious crisis in American history. For before his inauguration, Southern states finally acted on their threats. They began to leave the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.